Back with Nick Cook. It's been a while, mate. I think the last, well, we speak quite regularly, but I think the last time I had you on was almost a year ago now. How was Las Vegas?
Las Vegas was good, thank you, Jay. Are we going to give that any context? I mean, at the
Yeah,
moment, it
no,
just
I was
Las Vegas to have the most sort of hedonistic time. But of course, I know we're going to get into that, so that's all right.
Well, I think the hedonism just comes with the territory of being in Las Vegas, I guess. But no, you were there for a purpose.
I was. It was a little surreal because, and we might be able to circle back to this. I have spent probably more time in Las Vegas in my life than is good for me because, being on the doorstep of places like Area 51,
Right,
I've
right.
made, one or two documentaries, about that. And so, for better or worse, the production teams have usually put us in some kind of themed hotel in Las Vegas. So the last one I did, we were put into the Excalibur, which is, if you probably can visualize it, it is a truly terrible place. It is themed around a sort of Camelot-like castle. And the last thing you want, frankly, when you come back from quite a hard, grueling shooting day out in sort of the desert, is to come back to this sort of slot machine hell with people dressed as knaves jumping up to you and going, "Prithee, sire, dost thou want to play the slots?"
Oh
Or
my gosh.
so I did see when I went back to Las Vegas this time to pick up my Bigelow Bix Award. So that's the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies Award for an essay that I wrote on consciousness. When I landed in Vegas and I saw the Excalibur Hotel, I almost had a sort of traumatic flashback to previous times that I'd stayed there. But actually, it was all good fun, and it was obviously very nice to be able to pick up the Bix Award.
Well, yeah, you dark horse. I didn't know about any of this. I mean, I know you've been interested in consciousness for a little while. You've been kind of making that transition from just the nuts and bolts and the more platform orientated research into this part of the subject where consciousness and quantum mechanics seem to interpenetrate. It's a fascinating part of the discussion, but I had no idea that you were planning to write an essay for Bigelow's contest. So yeah, fantastic getting one of the winning essays. Can you talk about this a little bit? I'd love to know, well, first of all, why you decided to enter into it anyway, and what exactly was the focus of your essay?
So, let's sort of unpick and unpack that a little bit. The first point is that I mean, obviously, I have been interested in the UAP UFO field for a while. I mean, I haven't even really shouted that out too much because, I wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point about 20, well, it came out exactly 20 years ago, which I
Fantastic
always
book.
said, well, thank you very much. I always said, though, that it wasn't a book about UFOs. It was about top secret technology, particularly conjecturing or following an evidential trail as to whether there'd been a propulsion slash energy breakthrough, which had led to terrestrial vehicles that might look like UFOs. So, I brushed up against the UFO field. I'd shunned the true and proper UFO field because it was outside really my sort of true frame of reference professionally, and it was always taboo. I felt I'd sort of just about got away with it with the Hunt for Zero Point. I wasn't sacked from my job when I was researching it, and ultimately it got published. My job at the time was aerospace editor of Jane's Defence Weekly. Amazingly, they had me back after the book came out. But then I sort of left that whole field completely. And it was only in 2017 when the New York Times story came out about various US Navy revelations, Tic Tac and what have you, that I thought, well, actually, this deserves another look. And then it felt safer to take another look at it because if the New York Times is talking about it, you know, there seemed a sort of new mood abreast, which, you know, allowed people like me and scientists too to sort of get engaged in it. But I was very conscious when I came back to the subject that the nuts and bolts approach wasn't going to work. I'd read, you know, books by people like Vallée. In fact, I'd read a lot of UFO books. And I just found myself going round and round and round in circles, you know, through these often good, very worthy works. But there were no answers were forthcoming at all. And but in Vallée's work, I found some interesting approaches, which I felt probably deserved further exploration. And if I was going to jump back in at all, I felt that the psychic consciousness driven route would be a good way to do that. So that's just park that on one side. About 2 years ago, after I'd just written, I think the last time we were speaking, I was probably speaking about a thriller that I'd just written called The Grid.
That's which correct.
Which had consciousness as its backdrop. In fact, had remote viewing and consciousness as its backdrop. And I just became very intrigued by the whole consciousness sort of area of study when I was doing that research. And I thought, if there's any possibility of pursuing that as a sort of as something to study, I would really like to do that. But I had absolutely no excuse to do so. It's not an area that I'm aligned to professionally at all. And, you know, I'm doing other things. I've got to put bread on the table. And anyway, long story short, I get a grant after a research grant to go and research consciousness. And that enabled me to get as granular as I wanted to get on the subject of consciousness. And then weirdly, the way these things work out, this was sort of 2 years worth of study. I felt I was able to make inroads into all kinds of areas of consciousness, including the matter of consciousness's survival post-death. And then I thought, okay, well, that was nice. Let's park that. But I felt a need to discharge it. I mean, I'd got all of this sort of all of this research under my belt, and I had nowhere to place it. And as if by magic, Robert Bigelow crops up and launches this competition for his new enterprise, the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies, it's an essay contest for people to submit essays on the best evidence for the survival, proof of the survival of consciousness post-death. And I thought, I've done the work, I've done the research, let's give it a crack. It was never anything I was ever intending to do, but I did it. And I didn't tell anyone because I felt a bit of an imposter. It wasn't my field. So I just thought, well, look, I'll enter it. I'll see what happens. And if I get anywhere, great. If I don't, no one's going to be the wiser. So that's the story.
Well, you certainly have made an impact, you know, and I didn't expect you to be submitting an essay for this, so I'm really interested to find out what avenues you decided to take through this. So can you, I mean, obviously I understand it's probably quite extensive, but can you unpack a little bit about the kind of journey you decided to take with this?
I mean, I'm a researcher, but I'm a storyteller as well, you know, that's what I do. And so I decided to tell the story of my research really as a sort of an unfolding story. And it helped to sort of order my research and order my thoughts. So what I did was I started with the reasons why I got involved. And the reasons I got involved were because, I mean, the big trigger was my wife had what is called a shared death experience when her mother died. Her mother died 7 years ago. I was actually in the room when my mother-in-law died, and there were about six or seven of us there. And Ali, my wife, was holding her mum's hand. And at the precise moment her mum died, and they were extremely close, Ali turns to the rest of the room and just says, "She's all right. Everything's all right." And I'm thinking, what, you know, aside from the shock of it all, I'm thinking, what on earth is she talking about? Her mum, whom she loved very much, has just died, and she's turning around to the room and telling the room that everything's all is well. I think those were her precise words, all is well. And sometime afterwards, I asked her what she'd meant by that. And she said, well, she said to me, weren't you there as well? I thought you were there as well. In fact, I thought everyone in the room was there. And I went, where? And she said, I was in this place that was timeless, infinite, unbound, but connected. I knew everything. This place was more real than, you know, where we are now. I knew everything. Wow. Everything made sense. And she said, I thought everyone was there. And at that moment, I thought, whatever it is that you experienced, and I didn't really, I mean, I was probably somewhat aware of near-death experiences, but not much. I thought, whatever it is that you experienced, I've got to research this. I've got to know what this is. And that led, funnily enough, into my doing The Grid, the thriller that I wrote. And as I said earlier, from there, I got this research grant, amazingly, and that enabled me to really get into what it was she'd experienced. So that was the sort of inciting incident, really, that propelled me into this.
Are you able to say who provided the research grant, just out of curiosity? Or
I don't name him because I don't think he would want to be, but okay. He's a philanthropist.
Okay.
And we happened to connect, and this guy actually was, I didn't really even talk much about the whole consciousness thing, but somehow this guy just intuited that that's where my interest lay. And he said, how about I give you a grant to research this? And I went, that's fantastic. So it's extraordinary the way these things work.
Yeah.
Oh, one other thing too, actually, talk about setting your intention. At the beginning of that year, I tend to do this each year. I will stick up on a board my intentions for the year. And at the beginning of that year, I'd stuck on the board, I think the words were, I would like to research with the, engage in consciousness research with the greatest consciousness researchers on the planet. I had no means of achieving that at all. I mean, it was so outside of my field, but that was the intention I set. And a week ago yesterday, so this is Saturday, the 4th of December, I was gathered in the Bigelow Aerospace facilities with what I would consider to be the world's greatest researchers on consciousness. So, you know, the whole intention thing is something else.
Coincidence, you know, like it's hard to
it's hard to say that that is just coincidence,
right?
It's remarkable, as you know, Jay, because you know, we've talked about this before and you've written about it. If you set an intention, it is extraordinary, I think, how mechanisms at play within the universe, if we can call it that, kind of just click into place if I think you are aligned with some higher design or higher purpose, which seems to also be in play. I think if those two things kind of align, there's every chance that you will achieve your intention.
Absolutely. And I think it's an amazing thing that what I find really interesting about the whole idea of like kind of setting an intention is it's not like the universe, at least in my opinion, it's not like the universe is then going to suddenly pick you up and move you. You still have to do things. Like you still have to actually, you know, commit actions, talk to people, put some research in. You start yourself on that journey. But if you actually, I find that if you set an intention and then you actually consciously start performing actions, then things do come into that path that don't feel like they would have if you hadn't have done anything. But it's not so simple as, you know, you've spoken to someone and they've spoken back to you. Those types of things happen within that journey. But at the same time, strange coincidences like the philanthropist reaching out to you and suddenly giving you a research grant, like these are the things that seem to be the more synchronistic aspects of you actually performing an action. Because, you know, obviously you can't just manifest something and expect to sit back and it's all just going to come flooding towards you. There is always that part of it's, you know, it goes from thought to word to deed. That's kind of the basics of that type of manifestation. But at the same time, things then seem to almost be magnetically attracted to your path, and you'll pick up on those things. So it seems very much akin to what you've experienced with this decision to journey into consciousness research, which is appropriate because it's consciousness research.
Yeah, well, exactly. It sort of makes it all especially relevant.
Yes.
And yeah, it's true. You've got to put the work in. I think the trick is not just obviously intending, but also, as you said, committing. You have to commit.
Exactly.
Whatever it is. And once you commit, in fact, actually, there's that I wish I could remember the exact quote, but there is a quote attributed to Goethe, which says exactly that, which is, that once you commit to whatever this thing that you have intended, all manner of things will click into place to assist you achieve your aim. And it certainly felt that way. When I look back on it, it felt that way with this. So, you know, the culmination of it all last weekend was extraordinary. And I was able to reflect on it and slightly pinch myself and go, I think that it all did originate with that intention that I set myself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the same thing really did happen to me with this whole situation with the UFO subject. You know, I honestly, if I rewound time to 3 years ago, or maybe 4 years ago, and told myself that this is what I'd be doing, I wouldn't have believed a word of it. But there was literally, I mean, there were a few things that clicked into place on my journey, but there was a very synchronistic moment when I was literally sitting on my bed over there, and I've been doing a lot of research prior into consciousness and these types of more esoteric models for mind and the universe, but none of it seemed to apply to my life in a way that was tangible. I found myself almost falling into like a bit of a depression over it, because I was feeling like, okay, well, I've absorbed a lot of information and a lot of it does seem to resonate with how I feel reality is, but none of it, I can't do anything with this. It's all theoretical. It's all just quite esoteric. And I remember sitting on my bed and just kind of, I suppose you could call it praying, but I was just kind of talking out loud to the universe. And I said, I need something in this life that actually relates to this stuff that I've been learning in a way that I could, like something to do with my hands, you know, something that I can actually feel as tangible and real. And then I had, within a few weeks of that request, my experiences with the phenomenon and my journey into the UFO research field, which has since then just completely transformed my life. So it's a profound thing, the setting of an intention and then the strange synchronicities that pop up throughout your life as you progress through that. And I'm very happy to you know that you're taking this journey into the consciousness aspect, because especially as it relates to the UFO phenomenon, this to me seems fundamental. I mean, even Lou Elizondo has said similar things. He said once to Jim Semivan that he believes that the truth behind this phenomenon lies within the nexus of consciousness and quantum mechanics. And I think this is absolutely true. There is this fundamentally mysterious aspect, within many mysterious aspects, of course, of the UFO phenomenon. But the one that really seems most profound to me is this connection to consciousness and in some way, an ability for whatever these things are, whatever these intelligences are, to pick up on signals in consciousness, frequencies in consciousness, maybe even in some ways traverse what we would think of as astral realms or transdimensional realms, realms beyond just our physical constraints. There seems to be a lot suggesting that that's the case. And I have to obviously fall back on my own personal experiences, which were precipitated by an engaging with my own mind and consciousness and setting of intentions, getting into a meditative state and requesting for a form of contact to occur. And it occurred. So for me, there is this absolute keystone to the UFO issue, which is, why do they respond to consciousness? What is it about the mind interface that seems to have this connection with the UFOs? And it might not even be aliens in spacecraft. I mean, we know that this whole phenomenon could be a spectrum of different things going on. But within that spectrum, there certainly seems to be something that responds to the mind. And that fascinates me.
Well, I agree. And actually, that was really the sort of the nub of my Bix essay was, although, of course, we all had to answer the exam question, which was, you know, provide the best evidence for proof of consciousness's survival after permanent bodily death. But in order to answer that question, I felt that I needed to lay out a sort of canvas, a kind of ground, the groundwork for consciousness itself. I mean, science doesn't know what consciousness is.
Yeah.
No one does. I mean, because it imbues everything. It's impossible, in a sense, to analyze if you come at it head on. But my point was that on its periphery, there are phenomena, anomalies, that are there. They exist as paranormal phenomena, and there are a range of them, as you know. The UFO field is one. Yeah, ghosts, apparitions are another. There are near-death experiences, the way shamans interact with entities and the spirit world. So, you know, there are many ways into the consciousness field that mainstream science is just not exploring. My point in the essay, or one of the points in the essay, is if you want to begin to understand consciousness, pick away at its edges. I mean, the interesting anomalies on the edges of consciousness give us clues to what consciousness is. And if you go down those routes, and there are, you know, there's more than a half a dozen that you can go down amongst the ones that I've mentioned, but others too, that actually provide you with some real substance about what you're dealing with here. But moving on from that, I wanted to look at mind, certainly. I wanted to try and pick apart the difference between mind and consciousness. But the thing that I really focused on was what I called, and you mentioned it just now, the interface. Mm. I call it the interface because I don't think enough attention has been given in the UFO field to the interface. We tend to, it's quite natural because this is the way it seems. These things appear to us, but, and we tend to focus on them when they appear. But what we're not focusing on so much is the interface on which they appear. And I think that that for me was what I focused on in this essay. And I said, if we devote time, or if science devotes time, to understanding what that interface is, and, you know, to be sort of blunt, it is a screen that mind has an impact on, consciousness has an impact on, the brain also has an impact on, and the brain and the mind are two different things. You know, we begin to understand that the interface is a very malleable thing. Mm-hmm. It is not the, you know, I look out here and I see a laptop, I see a window, I see a table, and I see trees. And these are all things that are distinct and they seem separate. But, you know, the other thing that I point out in the essay is that organized matter is 99.9999% empty. It, you know, an atom consists of a nucleus and, you know, an orbiting electron shell. And, you know, it is, other than that, it is 99.999% empty.
Not much else going on, yeah.
So why is everything solid? Why is, you know, we have constructed somehow this interface. And if we could only understand that interface better, I think we would get to much closer to the answers that we seek on some of these anomalies like UFOs.
Well, you talk about the malleability of the interface, and I find this very interesting, especially because there is a resurgence of interest in Western medicinal science, neuroscience, and chemistry in general of psychedelics and psychedelic substances and what they do and how they impact the mind, especially. And I really find one of the most interesting psychedelics to be dimethyltryptamine, DMT. Because it's endogenous to our own neural chemistry. It's endogenous to our bodies. And I actually interviewed a guy, Dr. John Dean, who was one of the authors of a paper, I think it came out in 2019, where they were doing studies on mammalian brains in terms of the concentrations of DMT. And they were studying on rats, obviously. So there is obviously a potential that it's not fully representative of the human neural chemistry and body chemistry. But what they discovered was that DMT was actually in comparable levels within the brain to serotonin, which is a fundamental bodily hormone and governs most of the actions that we take in our life. If we didn't have serotonin, we'd be in a lot of trouble. So it was always thought that, at least in Western science, it was always thought that DMT was in trace amounts in the body, and so essentially inconsequential to you know, the interface and how we view reality. But if it is as it is in rats, if it is in human beings comparable to serotonin, then within, you know, within your brain, endogenous to your own biochemistry, exists a chemical where if one small tweak of its amount is introduced, the walls around you melt away and you're transported into some sort of hyperdimensional realm where people meet entities. And DMT is one of the most specific when it comes to literally meeting some form of entity that is so far beyond kind of syntax and description. You can't really understand it, but you know, people say that it's more real than real life, and it's so, it's an astonishing thing. The like you said, the malleability of the interface. We're on this base format perception, this kind of baseline perception. And, you know, even with transcendental meditation, people report very similar experiences to what can be described in psychedelic experiences. There's this shared space of how it represents itself. So I do think, and it definitely ties into quantum mechanics, and it definitely ties into, as you were saying, just how much empty space there is and all this stuff that feels so solid to us. There is definitely some aspect of the human brain body mind interface that can in some way tweak perception and phase out of this baseline that we seem to be operating in normal life. And it's very hard for people to kind of understand if they haven't had a direct experience, which is, you know, why, to be honest, and I don't say that everyone should do it, but it's why psychedelics are so important, because they're essentially a democratic way of experiencing something that usually is reserved for highly trained transcendental monks and meditators who can reach these supreme states. And it's a admirable feat to dedicate yourself to that type of discipline for meditation, but it's not something everyone can achieve. And so I do find the resurgence of interest in psychedelics, especially for a scientific lens, very interesting, because, you know, we're at the moment, in my mind, we're just tearing away from a reductionist, materialistic kind of, you know, imperialistic scientific model for the world that we've had for quite some time. And now we're going into, especially through quantum mechanics, a perception of reality where it's about fundamental energies at different frequencies that seem to be permeating up and then representing what we see and experience. And so if I would attribute the human being to some sort of biological quantum computer. We have this biology, this brain mechanism, this exquisite interface with reality. And I think that in some ways, if all points in space and time are connected through unseen energetic exchanges like electromagnetic frequencies and all of these energies that permeate through the universe, if all of that is essentially fundamentally connecting all of us together, that is like a computer network. And I would say that we're almost like nodes on a computer network. And if you can get yourself to a certain level of perception, a certain level of mind, I think you flash up on this network in some way that seems to be discoverable to other intelligences. There seems to be something about reaching a certain point in consciousness where you become viewable to other beings, and people have downloads of information through meditation, or they, you know, have messengers visit them, or you can even have these contact scenarios with whatever these intelligences are that engage in that type of situation. So for me, it feels like we are almost like nodes on a network, and through certain methods we can connect to different parts of that network, and this is a long lost discovery that we're re-remembering, but we're remembering it through the lens of science instead of the lens of shamanism.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I think the point I'd like to pick out that you talked about is this idea of nodes on a network. I mean, actually, again, that touches on something that I wrote in the essay, because again, I'm the storyteller. So what I'm trying to do, and one of the things that I was trying to do in that original 2-year research program, was find language that bridged the world of science with the experiencer lore, L-O-R-E, that is given to us from experiences, whether they are taking psychedelics, or whether they've had a UFO experience, you know, they're an abductee, or if it's a near death or a shared death experience. These models are quite hard to come up with. They're either trite and they don't, satisfy most people, or they're way too complex. I came across a scientist called Professor Donald Hoffman of the University of California, Irvine. His views are quite well known now. He makes this analogy about reality, the interface, being not unlike the screen that, you know, through which you and I are conversing now, in my case on a laptop. On that screen are icons. There are icons that I click on. I do not have to understand the guts of my computer in order to be able to work on it. I interface with it through those icons. I click on an icon and I get to where I want to go. I mean, essentially, Don Hoffman says the same thing, which is that we have developed over eons an infinite number of icons. I mean, any relationship we have, any action we carried out is through an icon. And yet, of course, if you stick to the computer analogy, what you have are depth layers and levels to my laptop, which would take me into hardware and software science, of which I just have no interest, and B, am eminently unqualified to play with my computer at that level. But the icon thing works for me, and it works for everyone. And more than that, you know, as a species, we've sort of developed a common set of icons that effectively have come down through evolution to us. So evolution has given us all the reality that we can handle through these icons. It gives us no more, no less. But yet we know that there are depth levels to the laptop, and there are depth levels to reality that we don't need. We don't customarily dive into. But were we to dive into those depth levels, we would find the realm of the experiences. We would find infinite layers and levels of, well, let's call it consciousness. But yes, operating within those levels and layers, there appear to be entities. And when those experiences, and one of the things, again, I say in the essay, is if you go down those 8 different sort of experiencer routes, you do, it seems, end up in a place where there are commonalities. And some of those entities, they may not be identical, but they start to look and sound not unlike each other. So again, this is something for me that is just intensely worth exploring, that there are, if you take these routes, you take these roads, it's not as if you end up with a bunch of squirrely anomalous data. You don't actually. You start ending up with data that has a lot of cross-correlation. And I, you know, to me, I mean, I'm a curious individual. I know you are too. Isn't this what science is about, or meant to be about? It's meant to be about the exploration of, well, it should be about the exploration of anomalies, but science doesn't seem to like anomalies very much. It certainly is about the exploration of patterns.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
within all of the stuff that we've been talking about, there is a lot of pattern. And this is what interested me. And, you know, so I pick up on it in the essay.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the issue with mainstream science, I suppose, and this is evident across the board with humanity, is it just comes down to ego a lot of the time. It comes down to not willing to relinquish your current model when something else is challenging that current model, because you've already had your awards and your peer reviewed, you know, pats on the back for doing such great work. And of course, it is great work. It keeps us going step by step forward. But each time there's that next step forward, those people that took the step previous usually have some level of resistance. I mean, a really good example is how, you know, SETI has kind of dropped the ball on UFO techno signatures and looking for extraterrestrial life in the universe through fast repeating radio bursts, when it turns out there's phenomena flying over the skies. So, and they suddenly get very upset when the Pentagon and the US government starts talking about unidentified aerial phenomena. Suddenly there's this robust reaction to that. So that, I think it does, and, you know, people like Neil deGrasse Tyson as well. So there are a lot of personalities that have, I suppose, concreted themselves within the current paradigm. And it seems quite evident to me that the paradigm is shifting, and that's going to cause some disruption to the current models. And so that's always going to be, I guess, an issue just on a human basis, when, you know, you've done a lot of work and suddenly your work is being ripped up underneath you and people are saying, oh, actually, it's something completely different now. It's not an easy thing to deal with. I like the comparison to the laptop and going deeper into the computer, especially because, you know, the deeper you go into a computer and the more knowledge you have of that, you can actually change the computer's behavior. You can change the reality of that computer. It's called reprogramming. You know, you can program the matrix that causes what you see on the interface. And I think that's probably applicable to deep levels of consciousness, and how you can in some way change the algorithmic sets of your local experience of reality, and things change around you, or your experiences change.
Yeah, and perhaps we could go a little further than that even, and say, or conjecture, whether in the past we have as a species been been through the interface, allowed resets, and allowed to have been, I hesitate the word to use the word reprogrammed, because it sounds really sinister, but in essence, if we are experiencing everything through that interface, if the interface goes through an upgrade every now and again, as my software system on my computer does, then everything resets. From what we're seeing at the moment, and it's easy to be seduced by, you know, you think you live in a special era, and, you know, we just happen to be seeing a lot of manifestations of unusual phenomena at the moment on the interface, as you yourself will testify to only too readily from your own experiences. But, you know, we seem to be living in an unusual time.
Yes.
I did not think that I would, you know, and I come from a background of defense reporting, pretty nuts and bolts, pretty sort of down to earth and grounded. I did not think I would live to see an era in which the Department of Defense would effectively acknowledge the reality of UFOs. I mean, okay, not everyone liked the report that came out in June, and it didn't go as far as most people would have liked, but yet it acknowledged the reality of the phenomenon. And it even set aside a bucket of weird stuff that sort of needed to be investigated. And as you and I know, you know, it's that bucket of weird stuff that actually is the stuff of interest.
Yeah, the other category.
The other category, exactly. I didn't think that I would ever see that day. And, you know, yet here we are seeing that and all the associated strange phenomena that has come with that, you know, and including, you know, for me, the US Navy being the, you know, the proponent that, you know, that was standing up amongst all the armed services of the United States saying that this phenomenon, you know, that they were being buzzed by something that defied their understanding. This to me is resetting the interface screen. Yeah. It is upgrading us, or at least it's upgrading the screen in a way that is allowing us to be more conscious, more sentient, more, I don't know what the word is exactly, but more in tune with some of those depth levels of existence that we don't customarily acknowledge or recognize. So it is an interesting time, to be sure. And I'm not entirely sure either that we haven't been prone to those resets in the past. I'm still intrigued. I don't know enough about it, but I'm still intrigued as to, you know, if you go back into prehistory, how it was that we became aware and sentient in the first place as a species. Was that as the result of some software tweak to the consciousness reality interface? Maybe. Who knows?
Well, it's hard not to recognize that we are fundamental outliers in planetary evolution and the natural state of things. I mean, this is another, you know, just like the mystery of consciousness and the mystery of the beginning of the universe and what happens after we die, another mystery is how did we become Homo sapien in the way that we are? How did this happen? What caused this absolutely phenomenal increase in cognitive ability and brain size within such a drastically short period of evolutionary time? That is a profound mystery. And there are a few different, obviously, there are a few different theories. The most prosaic theory, which I find quite funny, is the coordination of the throwing arm. And that's the idea that you know, an early point in our history, we had to make sure that we were keeping our distance from dangerous animals, and we learned you know, precise trajectory and throwing. And so as one of the lecturers I listen to a lot, Terence McKenna, says, that would mean that the highest exemplar of the human story is the baseball player. And you know, I as much as we all enjoy the baseball player, I don't think they are the highest exemplar of our march towards the infinite unknown of the human story. So, like, you know, there are all these different ideas. Obviously, within the UFO community, there's this idea that maybe we were meddled with, maybe something of a higher intelligence came in and decided to jump our DNA. And of course, there is, you know, some subtle historical reference to gods coming down from the sky and the Sumerian story of giving us the ability to speak. And so there is definitely some connection there that I entertain as a possibility. And another one, again, borrowing from Terence McKenna, is the stoned ape theory. And the idea that, are you familiar with the stoned ape theory?
I can only imagine that it's a primitive form of ourselves indulging in hallucinogenics, which might have turned us on. I mean, but tell me I'm wrong, all right?
Yes, you were right. It's an interesting hypothesis that he puts forward, because he talks about how that very early on in our prehistory, we made this exodus from the jungles into the grasslands. And this was because of, you know, most likely climatological stresses on the environment, which reduced the food that was available. And we made this this move out into the grasslands. And at the same time as this was taking place, there was also an evolution taking place in bovine creatures, which actually are one of the most preferred precursors for psilocybin mushrooms from the deposits of cows and different bovine creatures. Psilocybin mushrooms or magic mushrooms grow from these and have been growing out of these for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And so his kind of hypothesis was that when we were out in these grasslands foraging for food in a very nutritionally stressed environment, that we would have been flipping over cow pies, looking for beetles and grubs and things like that. And we would have come across chance selections of psilocybin. And I think what's interesting is psilocybin cubensis, magic mushrooms, has now been discovered to promote something called neural genesis, which is the reconnecting and distribution of neural connections in the brain. It basically, there's a brilliant image, which is of a placebo and a psilocybin graph of a brain showing kind of on and off. And the amount of neural connections in the person who is on psilocybin is profound. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of more neural connections going on in the brain. The brain lights up. So, I mean, you can imagine in early hominid history, encountering this type of thing would have been a profound accelerant for higher levels of cognition, because you're suddenly seeing pattern recognition, you're seeing these geometric patterns, and you're having interesting insights and thoughts coming through your mind. This is what this kind of thing does. And so there is this, and obviously there is a lot of evidence for early mushroom cults. You know, there was a lot of evidence for these early tribes, their artwork and their tools that we've attributed to the use of mushrooms. So I think that there's definitely, I would imagine it could be a whole multitude of different stimulants that cause this rapid increase in cognition. But I do like this idea of the stoned ape theory. I think it at least holds some level of influence based on historical record of the use of psychedelics and mushrooms and these mushroom cults starting up from early human history. So yeah, it's an interesting hypothesis. I would definitely recommend you have a little listen to Terence McKenna if you haven't listened to him much. He is someone that I have probably listened to an unhealthy amount of Terence McKenna, but his lectures have been preserved online for history. I don't think he ever imagined that would occur, but there are just hundreds and hundreds of his lectures, and he has some fascinating ideas around consciousness and science in general.
Yeah, I should. And I know that you're a fan, because I've read that when you've put that out. I've only recently picked up on this myself. I read a book by Graham Hancock.
Oh yes, love Graham Hancock.
Supernatural.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Supernatural. Yeah.
Supernatural. And in which he very much goes down that road. That introduced me to actually another idea, which was the symbolic nature of communication. Well, are we going to say from the universe? I mean, from consciousness. Graham Hancock goes into this idea of sort of, I think he calls them entoptics, which were sort of weird, squiggly, they're sort of hieroglyphic shapes that were amongst the first pieces of cave art to have been painted up on early hominid dwelling places, caves and the like. And that same pattern sort of recognition thing is reported by people who take psychedelics. So, you know, is there something fundamental about that the makeup of the fabric of reality that people see in those stripped down states of awareness? I don't know, but it sort of got me interested in the whole Jungian thing about then, symbolic communication. And, you know, if we are to learn the language of those deeper realms, you know, it ain't going to be English, French, or
exactly.
German. It's going to be in some other form. And we need to learn how to speak that language, or you know, what that language is telling us. And somehow, you know, we need to convert the, well, let's call it the 3D linguistics of the universe into our 2D brains. All of this, you know, I wish I were a scientist starting out, beginning of my career, because this would be fantastic, rich, unexplored areas of scientific endeavor that should, I would have thought, excite anyone wanting to get into the field of study of the brain and us and the human condition and, you know, our early origins. So, but let's hope. I mean, I think we are, as you said, I think we are embarking on a new era. And I'm glad to say, I mean, I understand, and you mentioned it too, that, you know, science has got a lot to protect. It is siloed, it's mainstreamed. Whole careers are built on these particular silos. I've always said, but I can afford to take this position. I don't come from a scientific discipline. I've always said that I always reserve in this field the right to change my mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you hold to a rigid position in this field, in my view, you are sunk, because there is something about consciousness, for a start, that likes to be one or several steps ahead of us. It is teasing and beguiling, and it clearly enjoys whatever it is, keeping us on our toes by, you know, presenting us with signs and symbols and wonders and manifestations that are part real and part not. I'm thinking of UFOs, but there could be any number of other manifestations as well, don't conform. So, if you hold to a rigid position in studying all of these things, I just don't think you're going to get anywhere.
Yeah, no, I agree. You have to be dynamic in this, because it is a forever changing landscape, in my opinion. And I think about the very short time that I've been in this research field, I've changed my mind multiple times, you know, and I continue, like you, to be open to the possibility of having to change it again. And I really like what John Ramirez ended his presentation with on my interview with him, where he said, embrace widely, but hold lightly. And I like that, because it's good to have an open mind. It's good to embrace things and look into it and be curious, but don't hold too tight onto it, because it could always change. It could always be different. And I think that is that we're at that point. I truly sense it. I mean, I'm looking at real world things, but just intuitively, I sense it. We are on the edge of a change in the way we view things, and it's coming up through all these different avenues. I mean, you know, setting aside the fact that on a political scale we're just in all sorts of trouble right now, I mean the dynamics of our kind of geopolitical system are just crumbling in many ways, in my opinion. So that's another catalyst for some form of acceleration in a change in that sector. But there are so many different avenues where, I mean, the rise of artificial intelligence and quantum mechanics and quantum computation becoming a thing, this whole idea of quantum entangled computers, which I can barely wrap my mind around. But, you know, these things, the psychedelics suddenly coming back into play, the UFOs suddenly becoming more prominent, all of these things, in my opinion, are doing this type of trajectory, because they all seem to correlate to one another. And I do find that the UFO is, in my opinion, it is like the highest exemplar of what happens when you merge the transcendental, the metaphysical, with the scientific, with the rational. You know, when technology and consciousness, or when science and spirituality, or physics and metaphysics move into this same shared space, in my mind, that's what the UFO seems to represent. It seems to represent an exquisite technological capability that also has within it, embedded within it, this profound understanding of mind and consciousness and the physics of reality. And it's almost like it's hanging above our heads going, come on, you're going to get there. This is where you're supposed to head to, you know?
Yeah, well, precisely. And, you know, it must be looking down at us and thinking, oh my God, they've got such a long way to go still.
That's I'm thinking as well.
Yeah. But I think that is fundamental to the, you know, to our understanding of the interface. And there's a great writer, you've probably come across him, Bernardo Kastrup. Bernardo, funnily enough, was another Bix winner. He had another winning essay, and I really like his work. And I'm probably only a third of a way through his essay. There are 29 essays to get through, but I'm about a third of the way through his essay. And you know, he also talks about the interface, but in a different way from me. His analogy is he's talking about the interface being the controls akin to the controls of an aircraft,
right,
on an aircraft flight deck. And the aircraft is flying through a storm, and you would not get a true rendition of the physics and makeup of the storm through what the instruments on the flight deck are telling you about that storm. But yet, you know, that is the best interface that you have when you're on the flight deck for gauging what it is that you're flying through. And he also talks very much about this metaphysical reality. You know, it is on the interface, because the interface itself is not what we think of it, you know, hard and fast, solid matter reality. These things that manifest on that interface can navigate it with adeptness. Yeah. I think it is telling that in, you know, abduction reports, you hear of extraterrestrial entities being able to go through solid walls, yeah, or go through windows. Yeah. Are they really doing that? Or does it say more about what the composition of the wall is, or what our perception of the composition of the wall is? So, you know, I call this, in my essay, I refer to it as a conditional reality. I think there are various conditions, yeah, as we know, that can give rise to weird phenomena. You need look no further than Skinwalker Ranch. I mean, but actually there are loads of other hotspots, as we know, where weird stuff goes on and happens. But, you know, certain conditions, I think, have to be present in these places for things to happen.
Yes.
We need to study. I mean, I know, you know, there's the History Channel and all of that looking at it.
No, we need proper study.
It needs proper, it really does, it needs proper study. And again, I hope science gets into that, because, God, if I were a scientist, I'd love to do that stuff.
Yeah, the phasing through the walls thing really interests me, because, you know, my little idea around something like that is that, as you were saying, it's primarily empty space, and then you've got the atoms and the electrons and the neutrons, and they're all spinning at such an incredibly fast speed. I mean, all of the vibratory particles inside solid objects are just moving at such an incredible frequency. And I kind of think of it like, if you think about a bike wheel and you spin a bike wheel really fast, try and put your hand through that, you can't. It bounces straight off because it's spinning so fast. It's giving this illusion of solidity and you can't go through it. But you slow that bike wheel down and eventually you can slip your hand right through that thing. And so it may be, you know, because, and I guess this is moving into like a slightly spiritual inclination of my own, but if we are kind of coalesced points of crystallized consciousness, you know, from a religious perspective, like the image of God or something like that, we're like these embodiments of consciousness in physical form. I think we probably do have, not in an aggressive way, but just the terminology, dominance over lower forms of matter in terms of vibratory particles, basic particles. We're a coalesced form that has consciousness, that is able to understand itself and its environment. And if we're going to look at it through the whole idea of we're connected to everything energetically, we just don't see it with our eyes, but we're fundamentally connected. Perhaps we can, in some way that is at the moment, inexplicable for humans, perhaps we can actually control matter, and maybe those beings are at a much higher level of understanding and can quite literally just tell that wall to slow down and move right through it like it was nothing but air. I mean, that's just my perspective on it, but I think about the vibratory frequency spin of particle physics and how it's all just going in there. It's like so intensely, you know, aggravated inside there. If you slow it down, maybe it is like a bike wheel and you can just slip your hand right through it.
Well, you know, I've been, we may have spoken about this before, but, you know, I've been privy to two occasions, actually, in which Uri Geller bent a spoon for me. Second time in my family. And you know, I know that there is, because I've seen it, you know, that malleability to apparently solid matter, which makes it much less well defined than we like to think it is, in the way that you've just been describing. I've no doubt that because everything is vibration and frequency, that there are tricks that can be done to apparently solid matter that give it another characteristic altogether. So if, crudely speaking, and I don't mean this unkindly, Uri, because I was very impressed by what you did, but if, you know, Uri Geller, a human being, can do that at the level that he does it at, imagine what an advanced consciousness may be able to do. So I just think we get a soupçon of it, a kind of smidge of it, with people like Uri. I mean, it's all to play for if you are a higher order consciousness.
And you know what, Nick, I honestly do think that we're not discovering this but re-remembering it, because I honestly do look back on, especially because I've become very fascinated in the, like, kind of the hermetic philosophies of ancient Egypt and the traditions around hermeticism and their philosophies, and it really seems to me that we, at one point, we really did have quite a solid grasp on the components of deep consciousness and what that might be able to do in this reality. And I think we have truly forgotten what we're capable of doing as these, biomechanical quantum computers, if we are these things. And I think we're in a process of re-remembering it through the cultural lens we've adopted, which is science. So spirituality, or whatever you want to call it, consciousness, metaphysics, it's coming through a very rigid system that was very materialistic and very reductionist for a long time. But now science is having to adapt and move into a much more esoteric understanding. I mean, you listen to some of these quantum physicists doing lectures, and you could translate it into a spiritual mindfulness talk if you just swapped a few of the different language components around. I mean, I can't remember the specific quote, but there was a brilliant quantum physicist who was giving a lecture who was just saying, the electrons in my body are the same as the electrons in yours, and the electrons kind of dividing us are the same. We're just this wave of information. And it's like, that is literally what people meditating on mountains for thousands of years have said to us, that we are all mind, we're all this one thing representing itself differently. So it really does feel to me that we've gone from the shamanistic to the technological to maybe the techno-shamanistic or the techno-spiritual. That I think that's where we're going, this melding between, and it's not religious, it's not a fundamental religious perspective, it's just a perspective that appreciates the nature of reality as this fundamental experience of energies representing itself in different forms. And we happen to be a form that is represented, not only just represented, but conscious of itself and conscious of its own experience and crafting a journey forward into trying to understand this reality. So I know that people do fall victim to thinking, oh, you know, each generation is the special generation, and we might, you know, we might be in for a lot of things ahead of us, which I'm sure we are. But I really do feel like this moment, the next few decades will probably reshuffle a lot of the models that we currently have in a lot of different sectors, and most specifically consciousness.
Yeah, well, of course, I think what it requires, or will require, is a little humility. It, mm. it, it, I mean, you know, you talked about ego earlier. I mean, one of the more fascinating things, again, in the research that I did for the Bix essay, was talking to researchers, great guy, neuroscientist called Dr. Peter Fenwick, who's done a lot of work on near-death experiences, shared-death experiences. He talks about the disintegration of the ego as being central to our appreciation of the malleability of the interface. As we approach death, our ego seems to go through some form of dissolution. You know, I mean, perhaps not surprisingly, you know, we spend our lives building up our ego as a shell to protect ourselves with, you know, our personalities with. As you approach the end of your life, and you know, if your collapse is a gradual one, you know, this ego dissolution, through it you begin to see things on the interface that you wouldn't customarily have seen. And I spoke to another fascinating guy called Dr. Christopher Kerr, who's a medical doctor who runs a hospice in New York. And he talks about the appearance of these familiars, as he calls them. You know, they are your uncle, your favorite granny, your pet even, who will appear to you in the last weeks of your life. They are comforting. That's why they are familiar. And they are there to guide you through the transition as this ego dissolution takes place. Science, in my opinion, has to go through something not dissimilar. It has to go through a bit of an ego dissolution in order to get through to where it wants to go, actually, because as we all know, science is stuck on some really big issues. Einstein was trying to crack the theory of everything, wasn't able to do it. And pretty much ever since, science has been trying to do something similar. And, you know, for the last, 25 years, we have been stuck with dark energy and dark matter. 95% of the universe is unknown. 5%, it constitutes the matter that we all recognize as, you know, the solid stuff around us and the universe that we can see. It's not really very good as a track record. But if you want to, I mean, you know, I think if science wants the answers to the things that it's stuck on, it just seems to me as a non-scientist that you've just got to be a bit humble and go, there are things that we don't know. And maybe exploring some of the things that we had decried as taboo actually mightn't be a good place to start. I mean, you clearly have had the greatest fun exploring this stuff. I have. I mean, it was a bit scary to begin with because professionally, I wasn't supposed to be doing it. But, you know, now that I'm not, you know, I'm my own agent, so to speak, I'm just having the best fun of my life exploring this stuff.
Oh, it's fascinating. I couldn't imagine doing anything else now. You know, I couldn't imagine doing anything else. There's a brilliant quote. Can't remember who said it. It was something along the lines of, science asks us, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the creation of all energy, time, and space in a single moment. And so, you know, we're still sitting here with this idea that everything just popped into existence from some explosion with no cause to it. And then everything else can be rationalized and explained away. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would actually, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you, are you familiar with the experience of a man called Dr. Eben Alexander?
Yeah, I interviewed him for my essay.
Oh, you, no way. Well, yeah. I might have to ask you to share some contact details. I want to get him on the, platform. I've been trying to figure out a way to reach out to him because I listened to one of his lectures on his story and it just blew me away. This neural surgeon who just had the most, I mean, mind-blowing experience. And he was a skeptic to begin with. So, you know, that's a good example of being humble. I mean, obviously, experience is the greatest teacher. It's not as easy when you're dealing with theoreticals, but when you actually experience something that forces you to change your mind, I think you either go deep in yourself and deny it, or you just change your model for reality. And I guess we need that in the wider scientific community. But yeah, his story I found fascinating. I didn't know you interviewed him.
Yeah. No, I was very lucky. I got, there was a point in my research where I said, I can either draw a line here, or I really dive into the deep end. And that deep end was populated by experiences. So I enlisted the help of Dean Radin, I'm sure you know of, if not know personally. Dean was great because he said, I need to get in contact with a range of experiencers who cover the experiencer set. So near-death experience, out-of-body experience, you know, shaman, remote viewer. I could do the remote viewing bit because I'd worked with Ingo Swann, but you know, various 8 different sort of experiencer types, including, you know, abductees and what have you. And Dean was brilliant. He just lined me up with people that he in his work, you know, either through IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or in other aspects and parts of his work, he just lined me up with these people, and they were sort of the best example. He'd already done the hard work. He'd got the best exemplars in these various experiencer disciplines. And one of them was Eben Alexander, who was fascinating, you know, just brilliant.
Yeah, he's a fascinating case. So now that you've kind of solidified your position as a thought leader in the journey towards understanding consciousness, you've submitted an essay, you've been given a big old pat on the back from Robert Bigelow, which is well deserved. What exactly, where are you going with this, Nick? Where do you want to go next?
Oh God, I wish I knew, to be honest. I mean, I'm fortunate in that, you know, I do consulting work. So I've got a sort of regular day job. I write books, which, you know, I really enjoy doing. So that's sort of my kind of bread and butter work. But this consciousness research stuff is just all consuming. And I just know now I'm in it that there, you know, you are never going to run out of stuff to research about consciousness ever. And in all the other things that I've done, you know, I mean, I started out as an aerospace reporter on a very sort of quite niche trade journal. And when I was there, and this was in my early 20s, I thought, I want to do this job for the rest of my life. It's brilliant. I love, you know, I'm this is what I love doing. But then, of course, you know, I got a certain way and I thought, oh, no, you know, I'll move on. I always found things in that job that sort of pushed my boundaries, or where I could push the boundaries out of. So after I'd sort of got to grips with the defense industry, then I started investigating black programs, you know, top secret programs. And that was easy. Not in there, it wasn't easy, but I was in the right place to be able to do that because of my job. And then, you know, before the Cold War collapsed, I was able to, you know, probe top secret Soviet stuff through, you know, intelligence sources and what have you. It was all really good, exciting stuff. I thought I'd never get bored of it, but I did. And my sort of swan song to that world was writing The Hunt for Zero Point, because that was, you know, I loved the world of defense reporting and aerospace reporting, but I'd been there, I'd done it. There was nothing more usefully I could do. So I wrote The Hunt for Zero Point, which was about a big taboo. It was about, you know, has an energy and propulsion breakthrough been made in secret? And then I moved on to other stuff. I did, for 10 years, I did consulting work. You know, I just got away from it all. But, you know, the whole consciousness thing has just pulled me back. And I just know that there's enough there never to get bored of. So I suspect I'll be researching it in amongst the other things I do for quite some time. What the outlets are going to be, I don't know. There might, you know, maybe a book or a film. I I don't know. But, you know, it's at the moment, I'm just sufficiently intrigued by the research not to have to worry too much about an outlet for it all.
Well, you know, these things develop organically anyway. You just got to set that intention, right, Nick? And then things will start falling into place.
Absolutely. Well, you know, pretty soon up on my wall, there's going to be the 2022 intention list. So who knows what I'll be putting up there as top of my list. Yeah.
Well, based on your successes with the Bix situation, I should probably start putting a piece of paper up on my wall by the sounds of it.
It only works, is all I can tell you, Jay. But, you know, I'm preaching to the choir, and I'm rather singing to the choir. So, you know, but it certainly worked for me.
Yeah. Let's let's wrap this up with one little thing with current events. How do you feel right now about the whole Rubio Gillibrand amendment and everything kicking off in Congress right now?
Yeah, I sort of came back to the UK from the States as that was all happening. So I missed some of the nuance to it. But I think it's a great development. I mean, it's been such a momentous year, all told, for the whole UAP.
Hasn't it just?
Just phenomenal. To sort of end up on that note, I think is terrific because, you know, as I may have said to someone else the other day, the idea of entrusting the DOD with analysis of the whole UAP UFO question, you know, whilst there's a certain amount that they can do legitimately, and you know, we might expect to get some information back on, this is a highly compartmentalized, it is riven with unknowns, secret elements, you know, and the idea of entrusting all of that purely to the DOD is just madness, frankly. What it needs is an outside agency to mandate this stuff. As with all other departments and agencies of Congress, there will be aspects of secrecy and levels of secrecy to it. You know, I get that. But I think that there will be a much better chance as a result of the Gillibrand amendment for us to know a bit more about what is going on than we would have before. So I think it is a wholly welcome development.
Nick, it is always a pleasure to have you on. I mean, you know, we, like I said, we do speak quite often, but it's been a little bit too long since you've been on here. It's really good to sit down and have a talk, especially about consciousness. We've been riffing off each other very easily with this, so I sense a lot of conversations in the future as you develop your work, as I develop what I'm doing. And obviously, for those who don't know, Nick is going to be in the Core Secrets documentary that I'm currently working on, with the hopes of getting it out before Christmas. So my next project will likely it's gonna have to be something about consciousness. You know, this is this documentary, although I'm sure I'll feature a little bit around that, it's more centered around the technology, the programs, where we might be going with that. But yeah, as you know, for me, this consciousness aspect is just the most profound, and it doesn't just relate to the UFO issue. It's one of the greatest mysteries of humankind is how are we even aware of each other, and how is this all happening? So, fascinating conversation, Nick, and I wish you the very best with this journey, and have a great evening.
Thanks, Jay. It's been a pleasure as ever to chat with you. Thanks very much.